Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near 90 FM. My name's John Dorney and today I'll be talking with our usual presenter, Cathal Brennan, about the postal strike of 1922. You're welcome, Cathal.
Thank you, John.
Cathal, the postal strike of 1922 occurred at a very precarious and a very eventful time in Irish history. Can you tell me something about the context of the strike?
Well, it's interesting because most histories of this period completely leave out the social aspect, completely leave out the union militancy, the rural militancy, all these different issues, and particularly the role that labour and the trade union movement played during the War of Independence. As you covered yourself there in the Irish story, with general strikes that were called for conscription and to release prisoners, these things are almost completely ignored. And if we look specifically at the postal strike, apart from Alexis Gilbride, Conor Costick, Emmet O'Connor and John M. Regan mentions it briefly in the Irish Counter-Revolution, you could read unlimited amounts of Civil War books and find no mention of this whatsoever. Even though this is right at the height of the Civil War, it's the first major industrial dispute that the new provisional government faced, and the way that they defeat the postal workers as well is very telling to the way Cumann na n-Éill will govern in future and the attitude to organised labour.
Mm-hmm. So it's an important moment in Irish history.
Yeah, very much so, because the postal strike not only represents the problems within Ireland, but it's like a wider issue to do with the general slump, economic slump in Europe after the First World War. It very much relates to paying conditions and how postal workers were paid during the First World War. Postal workers being part of the wider civil service, the argument goes that they have permanent pensionable jobs, what right do they have to be striking? They're in a far better economic position than most other workers in the country at the time. But postal workers are probably one of the worst paid jobs within the civil service at that time. Their basic pay is very low and hasn't really increased much over the last 20 years. I think it's only like 5 shillings over the last, over the previous 20 years it goes up. To compensate for this, there's a cost of living bonus that's paid twice a year to civil servants. And whereas most civil servants, their basic pay has gone up and this adjustment is a top up, for postal workers, this forms a major part of their pay. And the plan of the new provisional government to cut this at a time when prices are rising and have been rising all during the First World War provokes a real backlash among the postal workers.
And as you mentioned, this is a crisis all over Europe. I mean, inflation is running at something over 100% at the time.
Yes, like there was a big boom for Irish agriculture when the First World War started, and I think this was one of the reasons why, when you look back at the start of the First World War, like the first 12 months or so, the First World War was very popular in Ireland, even among nationalists, even among the Redmondite volunteers and people like that. That people who are opposing the war and people who are opposing recruitment are very, very much in the minority, a very small minority. And one of the reasons why it's viewed as popular is that there's a lot more factory work, it's great for agriculture, prices are going up, armaments factories are being built in Ireland. But correspondingly, while it's great for exporters and manufacturers and some levels of workers, the wage rises aren't quite keeping up with the inflation and the cost of living. Mm-hmm. As much as people are getting raises, food prices in particular are just exploding in this period.
Now, you mentioned there the provisional government. Can you tell us, first of all, or fill us in, what is the provisional government in Ireland in early 1922? And moving on from that, why is this government trying to cut postal workers' pay at this time?
Well, it's funny because we sort of have like a dual government period for about 6 months after the treaty is passed, the Anglo-Irish Treaty, between, as the British would describe it, the representatives of Southern Ireland, which came out of the 1920 Government of Ireland Act. Ireland is partitioned. And while the majority within Northern Ireland are quite happy for those structures, and those are the structures that they live under up until Stormont is prorogued in the 70s, a virtually identical system is proposed for the 26 counties. But nobody is really happy with that. And the representatives of the Dáil go over to negotiate on behalf of the whole of Ireland. But as far as the British are concerned, they're negotiating with Southern Ireland. Anyway, this passes the Dáil by a very slim margin of 7 votes in January of 1922. So under the treaty, the provisional government comes into effect. But the Dáil continues on with Arthur Griffith taking over as president from De Valera.
And the Dáil, remember, listeners will remember, is the Revolutionary Assembly of the Irish Republic.
Yes.
So, according to some, it's still a republican institution. According to the British, it's the Assembly of the Irish Free State, or Proto-Irish Free State.
Absolutely. While the anti-treatyites resigned from government within the Dáil, they continued to sit in the Dáil. So for this 6 month period, the Dáil is still sitting until the general election in June. And it becomes part of the Republican mythology that because that body wasn't formally and properly dissolved before those elections, the Second Dáil continues on. And then they're able to pass on, in later decades, able to pass on their authority to the IRA. And when we have the provisional government then, is chaired by Michael Collins, while Arthur Griffith continues on as President of the Republic. In some ways, the new provisional government's being held to account by the Dáil, by anti-treatyites, through discussions. One of the first things that they do is that they have to create a state. And one of the most important things in this state is the Postal Service. So J.J. Walsh, a TD for Cork, becomes the Postmaster General in the new Provisional Government Cabinet, later known as the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs. When he takes over the department, he appoints PSO Hegarty as the Department Secretary. O'Hegarty is another Cork IRB man. He would have been a schoolmate of Walsh. He would have went over to London with him at the same time to join the Postal Service together. But as the Civil War goes on, he becomes increasingly reactionary, and you can see that in some of his books, like The Victory of Sinn Féin. Same with Walsh himself, because Walsh would have been active in the Volunteers, he would have been active in the GAA. He was actually kicked out of the Postal Service for writing to all the newspapers, complaining about Cork Corporation giving the freedom of the city to the Lord Lieutenant. Under the Defence of the Realm Act, he's actually moved to Dublin, he's moved out of Cork, and he's known as being somebody who's quite left-wing and quite militant within the postal unions. So this way, I think his behaviour, once he becomes the Postmaster General, is viewed as so surprising or so upsetting by the postal workers.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things they do is they aim to remove the cost of living allowances, the bonuses. This provokes a huge outrage among the postal sector workers. And it's funny when you look at this, that every time J.J. Walsh gets involved in the dispute, he makes it 10 times worse. It's like he's going out of his way to antagonise the postal workers and the unions. But one of the first things he does is he writes to the Postmaster General in Britain and asks, can he provide replacement workers to come in, Irish postal workers living in Britain who want to return, that they will replace striking workers. Now this gets out, and there's huge anger among all organised labour in Ireland. Even the other minister in the provisional government, Sinn Féin minister, who could be said to be from a Labourist background, Joe McGrath, won't support it in the Dáil. He's questioned by Constant Markovitch, and he's very embarrassed. And privately, he threatens to resign over it. And then Walsh denies that he's ever said it, or ever sent it in the first place. He said, oh, well, we're hoping now to look for Irish people in Britain, loyal workers who'll work for the provisional government, as if this is any better, like that being replaced by an Irish blackleg is better than being replaced by an English one. So it comes very, very close. There's three unions then representing postal workers in Ireland. There's the Irish Postal Union, the Irish Postal Workers Union, and the Irish Post Office Engineers Union. So the three of these sort of come together. When the strike actually does begin, they form the United Postal Union. But we're dealing with a period where works are far more militant than we're used to at the time. And the level of union membership is far higher than it had been at the start of the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
Like after 1913, there's a huge, huge dip in union membership. But that grows towards the end of the First World War, during the War of Independence. And the different unions have played a large role in the War of Independence in their own way, calling general strikes against conscription, in calling a general strike to highlight political prisoners and to get them released.
The railway boycott.
Railway boycott, to refuse to move munitions or to move troops. And particularly, and this really sings from the postal workers' point of view, is that the postal workers have played a big role in the intelligence networks for the IRA. And we seem to forget nowadays just how much the economy at the time depended on the postal service.
Mm-hmm.
The postal workers covered telephones, telegraphs and posts, and a lot of commerce was conducted by the postal service. You'd send your goods, that's how you contact businesses and such like. So this had capacity to really cripple the Irish economy. To try and resolve this, the government forms a committee to look into the issue of wages and cost of living bonuses, and they ask James Green Douglas to chair it. Now, Douglas is a Quaker businessman, and he served as a trustee on the White Cross, which was organised to distribute relief to the families of Republican prisoners. He was very trusted by Collins and other people within the provisional government. He comes across as very fair in a lot of ways. Like when they meet, and it also has two representatives from the Irish Parliamentary Party, funnily enough, old MPs and two trade unionists. When they meet and they look into the cost of living in Ireland at the time, they're quite generous in a lot of ways. So when the Postal Commission meets, it meets initially towards the end of March, and it holds public meetings to talk about cost of living, interviews different people, and it comes out with an interim report on the 11th of May. And in a lot of ways, it's very favourable to the postal workers. It said that they find it very difficult to cope with the wages that they're on, and if they had to adjust their living conditions to these new wage rates, it would cause immense hardship. They actually recommend that the basic wage is brought up by 12.5%, so compensating the workers for the reduction in the bonuses. And they said that before any further action is taken, particularly to reduce their pay, there should be a proper cost of living index for Ireland agreed upon by all sides, and the commission would have to finally come out with its report before anything could be done. So they planned that the final report would be out around the start of September. Now, while this is going on, the political situation in Ireland, the military situation, is getting far worse. We're getting closer and closer towards civil war. So one of the things that the provisional government does, first they have the general election in June, so disregarded as giving them the legitimacy to continue on, that this is like a rubber stamp for the Free State and it's a validation for the treaty. Probably a bit more complex than that when you look at how the numbers stack up and the idea of a packed election before that. They basically scrap the commission and they say we're going to produce our own figures and we're going to adjust the bonuses based on them. So they produce their own figures and this just causes uproar among everyone, not just like the trade union leaders, but even TDs who wouldn't be favourable to the labour movement. They regard the figures as absolutely ridiculous. They bear no relationship to the actual costs in Ireland at the time. And then through them, they go ahead and they reduce the bonuses, reduce the wage rates. So the response of this is that the postal unions come together and they declare that they're going to have a strike. So this strike is planned to go ahead in the first week of September, and it's very, very popular among the postal workers. There's a lot of support for this strike. So the response from Walsh is that through him and PS O'Hegarty, there are messages sent to all the postal workers that any man who goes on strike will be dismissed immediately, and if any of these people are later rehired, all their pension entitlements will have been wiped up to that point. So this sort of inflames things further with the postal workers. And at the time, again, Walsh continues to make statements regarding the postal workers and give interviews to newspapers like the Irish Independent, saying that the postal workers have never done anything for Ireland. They never struck while the British government were here. And now the minute we get an Irish government, the first thing they do is go on strike and they don't know how good they have it. The response then from the postal workers is obviously to talk about the general strikes, to talk about, like, you know, their role in the intelligence networks. At every stage, he seems to make the relationships worse between the pair of them.
Now, the postal strike, as you've pointed out, would have been a pretty serious matter for a nascent Irish government anyway. What makes it an extremely serious matter is the fact that civil war has broken out in late June, early July 1922. So does this make the provisional government really feel like their back is up against the wall?
Yes, because one of the things they do when the postal strike begins is they declare that no public sector worker has the right to go on strike. At this stage, they're still forming the National Army. It's still taking shape. It's officered in the main by men who were pro-treaty IRA officers. And there's a big influx into the National Army. There's maybe 60,000 soldiers and men by the end of the Civil War. Many of them had no role previously in the War of Independence, but it's a well-paid job. It's pensionable. There's hope for their work afterwards. And it seems that the view from a lot of the pro-treaty politicians is that the postal workers going on strike is little different than the anti-treaty waging war against the provisional government. It's another attack on a new Irish state. And from their perspective, their idea was this is the first native Irish government in 800 years. For all the struggle with Britain, we finally have a native government, and the first thing that the postal workers do, in their opinion, attack it and go on strike and try and destabilise the country. The biggest issue with them is stability, to bed down the state, to bed down the treaty. And at this time as well, like, you know, there's arguments regarding, well, just previous to this, arguments regarding the constitution, how the election was fought, would it be packed, would it be a coalition with the anti-treatyites? And there's a lot of pressure coming from Britain with how the provisional government are conducting themselves. There's very little sympathy within the pro-treaty regime for the postal workers.
Mm-hmm. So by the time the strike is actually called or breaks out, or the pickets go out in early September, you're in a violent situation, almost a paranoid situation. The government sees threats from every direction. So how does this affect the actual conduct of the strike? This is a strike that's more violent even than what strikes at that time.
It's quite violent, even in comparison to the response of the British government to strikes during the War of Independence. There's no comparison whatsoever. When the strikes begin, firstly, Amiens Street there at the Central Telegraph Office, the picketers are arrested en masse, 50 of them brought down to the cells, and one Dublin Metropolitan Police constable who queries whether this is legal to actually just arrest picketers en masse is dismissed as an example to arrest them. As the strike goes on, picketers are regularly shot at. One female picketer is shot at Merchant's Arch. Very lucky, she was shot in the back, but it was deflected by her bra buckle, and it actually...
They made things to last in those days.
She was brought to Jervis Street Hospital, and it had gone into her leg. In Limerick as well, the picketers were approached by soldiers in civilian clothes, and when they were stopped and asked not to pass the picket, that's taken as a signal to attack the picketers, and 15 picketers are very, very badly beaten, pistol whipped, had their skulls cracked with rifle butts. And bear in mind, 5 out of 15 were women, hospitalised. There are mass arrests. But the funny thing is how solid the strike is, despite this. It's very, very solid. During this period as well, the Postmaster General contacts schools, saying there's work for lads who are finishing up in school to do postal work. They create flying columns of scab workers to go around the country to deliver mail. And funnily enough, a group down from Belfast who had come down to Dublin to escape the sectarian violence are asked, will they do postal work? And when they refuse, they're sent straight back to Belfast. So it carries on for about 3 weeks, the strike. A lot of these strikes, it seems that the Labour movement, the Labour Party and the trade union leadership weren't willing to push it on further to call a general strike or to bring out all workers. And it is quite a serious point for the Labour movement, the right of public sector workers to strike. And not only that, but the right to peaceful picketing, all these type of things. The picketers there at the top of O'Connell Street near the rink, near the rotunda, armoured cars driven by soldiers drive up on the pass to disperse them. They drive straight into to picketers. The strike committees have to move because they're raided by the military. And it's part of a wider problem with the way that the provisional government during the Civil War reacts to labour disputes. It's very, very clearly on the side of employers, large farmers, and is quite brutal in the way it puts down not only urban strikes like the postal dispute, but rural radicalism. The North Munster Soviets, the creamery and flour mills workers, the labour disputes in Waterford for rural labourers on big farms is quite brutal.
Patrick Hogan, the Minister for Agriculture, is pretty explicit on this. He says exactly this, that the farmers are the mainstay of the country. They're going to be the mainstay of the country, and what he calls wreckers, you know, agitators, just need to be put down. So it's, you know, it's not even a polemical thing to say. This is what they actually said at the time.
Well, especially when you think of the role of the Special Infantry Corps.
You mentioned there the Labour Party and the Labour movement. I want to talk a little bit about the political context. The Dáil, the Irish Parliament, had elections in June, but had not yet been called in September. And one of the reasons why it was called was the postal strike. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
The Labour Party had done very, very well at the June 1922 election. And because the anti-treatyites had said they weren't going to take their seats, in effect, the Labour Party becomes the unofficial opposition. But the first thing is to get Stahl to actually meet. And this takes months. the Labour Party are constantly contacting Michael Collins, asking him to call the Dáil to sit. This doesn't happen. Every time they try and get it to happen, there's an excuse not to. Finally, the Labour Party are mandated by the Irish Labour Party and Trade Union Congress to resign their seats en masse if the Dáil doesn't meet. And then Michael Collins is shot towards the end of August. So this is a further delay. So eventually the Dáil meets, but it meets right at the same time that the postal dispute is starting. So this is a major, major issue for the Dáil, the third Dáil, as it meets. Thomas Johnson, the leader of the Labour Party, he wants to bring up the issue regarding the right of public sector workers to strike. And Kevin O'Higgins, JJ Walsh are quite clear that, as far as they're concerned, there is no right to strike whatsoever.
For public sector workers.
For public sector workers. They have the right to resign if they don't like it, but they do not have the right to strike. And you can see this as well when the dispute actually comes to a close. Cosgrave is met with the leadership of the Labour Party and the trade unions. He agrees that there won't be any victimisation. They'll look into the cost of living bonuses. But JJ Wells doesn't feel bound by this at all and carries out a quite serious campaign of victimisation of postal sector workers. It takes about 10 years before this is resolved, until actually Cumann na n-Éill are gone out of government and Fianna Fáil take over the government in 1932, before a lot of these issues are resolved regarding the pension entitlements and victimisation. There's a lot of anger that they feel that good postal workers have been sacked while scabs who were taken on during the period have been promoted or kept on even though they haven't passed the proper exams or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it does lead to a lot of anger there.
Mm-hmm. And what are the nuts and bolts of the settlement? I mean, do they get more money basically to cope with inflation or not?
No. That's why it's so strange in a way that the settlement at that period, they settled but they only got the vaguest of commitments to look into it. They didn't get anything concrete at all. So the cuts still go ahead. As we said there earlier, it's part of a much wider attack on wages and conditions throughout the period. It's part of the whole ideology that Cumann na n-Éill have through their 10-year period of keeping wages static or reduced, focusing on agricultural exports, balanced budgets, very low public spending. So this comes into conflict with, before the postal dispute and before the Civil War, a very confident and militant labour movement in Ireland. But unfortunately, as you know, I said with several things, because of partition, some of the most vibrant and most militant workers in Ireland are partitioned off from the rest of the country.
This is just how the new government, as it becomes in 1920, late 1922, 1923, the Free State government, it's just how it views things. Wages must go down in order to make business more profitable so that we can start getting tax in and make the country viable. And their point of view is, again, as you said, they're doing it for Ireland, they're doing it for the new Irish state, but not everybody benefits from this, to say the least.
It's been written about elsewhere, about the strikes at Ardna Crusha, that when Siemens came in to build Ardna Crusha, they were willing to pay a higher rate, but the government didn't want demands for wage rises. The conditions are very, very difficult at that time for Irish workers. You can see as well that during the debate when Fianna Fáil first enter the Dáil and there's a motion of no confidence in the Cosgrave government, it's proposed that the Labour Party will take over, supported by the National League coalition, with Fianna Fáil supporting the new government from outside. During that debate in the Dáil, there's a lot of opposition from, particularly from the Farmers' Party. How can we trust the Labour Party with government? These are the people who were setting up Soviets. These are the people who were riling up the rural workers and destroying agriculture, etc., etc. So that suspicion of Labour doesn't go away. That class antagonism is still present, even a couple of years after this.
And finally, Cathal, what does this tell us, do you think, about the end of the period we're calling the Irish Revolution? And how has it been remembered, if at all, in history?
It's very funny the way this period is remembered, especially for a long time, that the idea of the birth of Irish democracy, the other catchphrase that social agitation ended with the Land Act.
Right.
You know, it couldn't be further from the truth. And you don't really get a full idea, a full understanding of the revolutionary period unless you look at the labour difficulties, unless you look at the land difficulties, unless you look at the class differences. And it's remarkable that people would try and diminish them or ignore them. obviously you can't talk about everything, but to completely dismiss them seems to give a completely false picture of the period. It does go some way to explaining why Fianna Fáil were so popular after 1932 and why Cumann na n-Éill and later Fine Gael were so unpopular with large sections of the Irish people in that initial period. You put it into a broader context of the shilling off the pension. They're viewed as very conservative and unsympathetic to the poorer sections and the labour movement. And they seem to have a remarkable quality for saying and doing the wrong thing and roiling people up. Not just J.J. Walsh and his interviews to the newspapers. During the same period that the cost of living increase is being published, the one that the government wrote themselves and published, which was widely attacked and viewed as fancy, the provisional government, the cabinet, increases salaries for ministers from £700 to £1,700. And it's a real populist thing by Fianna Fáil, but it's like an open goal from their point of view. When they get elected in 1932, the first thing they do is they slash ministers' salaries. And it's really popular. But how they thought this was good idea, Cumann na n-Éill, to increase their salaries by £1,000, by more than 100% in one of their first acts as a new government. And it's constantly sending the wrong messages. It's not clear whether they're just tone deaf or they want to send a very strong signal to a militant labour movement that we are going to do what we're going to do. You're not going to get away with us what you did with the British. You can see as well with Liam Mellows as one of the anti-treaty leaders who really sees potential during the Civil War for anti-treatyites linking up with the labour movement and using social grievances to destabilise and ultimately bring down the Free State and the treaty. Shortly afterwards, he's executed for something that happened long after he was imprisoned. There's lots of what-ifs here. Like, what would have happened with the postal dispute if Connolly was still running the transport union, if Larkin wasn't in America, if the Labour leaders had behaved differently? It seems to be one defeat after another. And in a way, it could be said that when Fianna Fáil did come on the scene, many natural Labour supporters are quite happy to support Fianna Fáil. And this becomes the case for decades to come. Small farmers, urban workers, because the Labour Party don't really seem to have the guts to challenge the government. They certainly don't in this period, and for a lot of the Cumann na n-Éill period, they really don't either. Their challenges are weak and ineffectual, and this is argued one way or the other. The strike that they carry out against militarism before the Civil War, it's a general strike against militarism. They say it's a strike against all armed people and the rush towards war, but the pro-treatyites portray it, maybe unfairly, as an attack on anti-treatyites, as this is the Labour movement standing away from the anti-treatyites, saying that Labour will not support their attempts to bring down the Free State. From the Labour Party's point of view, they see a potential within the Free State to ultimately become the government of the Free State at some stage, to bring in a reformist programme of improving conditions. But that never really becomes the case. Where it becomes an issue whether attacking the government and using their industrial muscle to attack the government on a labour issue might actually destabilise the Free State, they always back off.
Okay, that was very interesting. Thank you very much, Cathal Brennan. And for me, John Dorney, goodbye.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on this episode we will be joined by author and artist Gerry Hunt to discuss his recently published graphic novel, 1913, Larkin's Labour War. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, go to the Near FM podcast page or like us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/ The Irish History Show. You're very welcome to the show, Gerry.
Thank you, Carl.
What first attracted you to comics and graphic novels as a medium?
Well, I'll tell you, Cathal, now, I've been reading comics since before I could read. When I was about 4 years of age, I had a friend who had relatives in America, and every few months they would send him a bundle of comics. And when he got those comics, he'd call into my house, because I was only up the road, and we'd go down and we'd spend the Saturday just lying on our tummies on the floor reading these comics. And I just got fascinated by the whole thing. And then as I grew up, I sort of became interested more and more. People call them comics, and some people call them graphic novels. To me, they'll always be comics, because my memory is that back in France and Spain and that, they had comics since the very early days, since the 1830s. While in America, comics were always regarded as being for children. They were mass-produced on a conveyor system. They had to be out every week, and they were comics for children. Until one day, a fella called, and I think his name was Richard Kyle, he went to Europe, and he saw these comics in Europe, in France and places, but they were for all ages. There were comics for children, there were comics for teenagers, comics for grown-ups, but they were all called comics. And he thought this was terrific. We've got to get this in America. And he came back to America with the idea of doing comics for grown-ups. But being an American, he couldn't call them comics. As far as he was concerned, comics were for children. So he made a few attempts, and eventually they came up with the name graphic novel. Now, there was a great artist in America, a man called Will Eisner, who drew right up until he was 89. He was very well known, and he didn't really go for the word graphic novel. He called them something like Transcendental Comics or something like that. Some weird name that I can't even remember rightly. But that's how the word graphic novel came about, this guy Richard Kyle, because he meant that these were for grown-ups rather than for children. To me, comics are comics. And if you want them for grown-ups, you draw them for grown-ups. If you want them for children, you draw them for children. But I have to call them graphic novels because that's what my publisher calls them.
But it really attracted you always as a medium, as opposed to, say, writing a novel or writing a short story.
When I got to a certain age, I always had at the back of my mind that I would like to do comics. And being a bachelor and not having a mortgage, I retired at 50. I worked as an architect up until then. And I spent 10 years studying art. Now, I never went to an art class, but I knew I could draw, but I had to bring it up to a certain level where I thought it would be acceptable on a comic shelf, in a comic shop. And when I thought I was at that stage, I produced a comic for my friends, and the reaction was fairly okay. Well, you'd expect that anyway from friends. So then I decided to go another stage, and I produced a comic myself called In Dublin City, which was fiction. And I brought it down to the Forbidden Planet, and they put it on the shelf, and that was the proudest day of my life. And that really sold me. I decided I had done the right thing in retiring early and concentrating on the comics, and that's what I've been doing now for the last 10 years.
And 1913 isn't the first graphic novel that you've written about Irish history, is it?
No, no. In fact, the first comic that I did for a publisher was 1916. It was called Blood Upon the Rose. And it was very funny how that came about, because I had been publishing and I had been starting to get on fairly well doing fiction when I got a call from the publisher, and he asked me would I come down and see them. It was O'Brien Press, and I met them. And before I met them, I had been talking to the lad who illustrated for me, and we were talking actually about getting away from fiction and going into history. And I talked about doing 1913, and he said, well, why don't you go the whole hog and do 1916? And we agreed on that. And when I went into the publisher, he asked me, had I anything in mind for a new work? And I says, yeah, we're thinking of doing 1916. And he started to laugh. And I wanted to know why. And he says, well, that's exactly what we want you to do. So that started me on 1916, Blood Upon the Rose. And it went pretty well. It's now in its third print. So after that, of course, the natural follow-on was 1919. With Michael Collins, which we did, and that was actually shortlisted last year. So we found that things were going fairly well in the comic world. So now I've done, as I say, The Lockout, Larkin's Labour War, and that's just in the shops a short while, so we're just waiting to see how it goes.
And how do you find the actual process, the pre-writing process, the researching a story, deciding what characters to concentrate on? How do you find that as an artist, that process?
I find that discipline something that I'm not accustomed to, because when I started myself, I never did a story. It was always just an idea. I might get it in bed at night and I'd think about it, and I'd sit down at my board the next day and I'd develop the idea a little bit, and as I developed it, I would draw the different panels to suit, and it went on and on. And I'm not joking you, Cahill, I could be halfway into that comic, and I still wouldn't have a clue how it was going to end. And eventually, when I got fed up doing it, I would think of an ending for it. But the whole thing changed when I got a publisher. Then I had to do, and especially when it was historical, I had to do research. I had to write up a story which was approved by the publisher, and then I had to start and illustrate it. And I found that a discipline which I had to get used to, and it took getting used to, I can tell you. But now I'm into it, it doesn't worry me.
And do you find much inspiration, not just from reading the dry facts as a writer and coming up with a plot, but as an artist, from looking at the art from the period, photographs, things like that?
I do indeed, yes. I find all photographs terrific because it shows how people were dressed. It shows, especially with Irish history, because we came through some awful times. Nowadays, we don't really appreciate it. But, I mean, if you think about 1913, if you think about 20,000 families in the inner city living in tenements, and when you see photographs of those, and there are an awful lot of old photographs available, which for me is a godsend, because without them you just wouldn't be able to get the scenes right. And I like to be as factual as I can, and I like to show it as I think it was. And, I mean, if you think of the conditions that people... If you take 1913, it took me ages to get my head around the situation. When I was young, we were poor enough, but we still had three bedrooms in the house. But if you think of maybe two families in one room, I mean, how do they get a bit of privacy? Do they put up curtains? Do they put up blankets as partitions? And what do they do at night when they have an outside toilet? Maybe two toilets for 150 people, and you have children, they want to go out and it's teeming rain. They don't go out. They might use the stairs or they might use a bucket, and the smells must have been awful. And we just cannot appreciate that. So we don't live in those situations anymore. So I like to try and just get a real feel for the thing before I can actually sit down and draw it.
Do you find in some ways that's an advantage of comics and graphic novels as opposed to, say, a history book? With a graphic novel, you can actually draw those details and put the reader in that situation.
Well, I like to think that. I like to think that that's a plus for the graphic novel as opposed to a book. Now, a book is all words, and it's down to the writer to come up with a way of saying things and explaining things that might sort of hold a person's interest or fascinate something. I think with the drawings, when you just look at it and it hits you in the eye, and, you know, the more you can get into the details, and I suppose it comes down to how good you are as an artist, that you can really get it across in a drawing. I think it's a terrific thing for people. And when I started drawing comics first, we didn't have a history of comics in Ireland. We didn't have a culture like they did in America or in France or in England even. And I remember the first time I went into the Forbidden Planet, I saw a little carousel in a corner, and handwritten over it was Irish comics. And these were comics submitted by young lads, 14 or 15 years of age. And they were very badly done because these lads had no money. They were just stapled together and that sort of thing. That was about 12 years ago. Since then, it has come on by leaps and bounds. And that's because more and more good artists are getting into it. They're being able to produce them properly. And people are starting to say, yeah, this is a great way of telling a story. And more people are buying them.
And would you draw your stuff out by hand, or do you use any of the new technology?
No. I draw by... I'm very old-fashioned. And that's why I have to get an illustrator to colour my comics, because these guys who are half my age, they're weaned into the computer, they do all their colouring by computer, and it's terrific. I cannot do that. So I draw by hand. Now, I have to draw by pencil first, and then I ink it in. And that's the way anyone who draws by hand does it that way, and anyone who lets on that they do it straight with a pen is telling you lies, Cahal, because it's impossible. With a pencil, you can rub it out. You cannot rub out a pen. So I draw by pencil, then I go over it in ink, and when I'm happy with it, then I pass it on to the illustrator.
And when you're doing a graphic novel about a historical subject, like 1913, is it hard to decide at what angle you're going to take it from? Which characters you're going to concentrate on? And same with 1916, the War of Independence one as well. Do you find it frustrating in a way sometimes to size the medium? Do you have to limit yourself, or is that good discipline for you as an author?
It's a discipline, but it's also frustrating because if you take, as you say, 1916, I limited that to something like 58 pages. Because that's what, in fact, now that I think of it, I think it was down to 48 pages. Mm. Now, I had enough information on that to fill at least 200 pages. Mm. So it was a good discipline. But you've got to decide when you read through it who you're going to concentrate on. Mm. And for 1916, for example, James Connolly was a terrific man. But for me, the guy who stood out more than anybody was Joe Plunkett, because Joe Plunkett was a very sick man. He got up out of his hospital bed to join the Rising. And the fact that he got married 2 hours before he was executed, that really appealed to me. I think there's a film there, definitely. And so Joe Plunkett stuck out for me. But after that, then it was Connolly and all the leaders. And all the volunteers, the only reason I don't mention volunteers is that I don't know their names. Now, my father was involved, but they were all, to me, you could have done a book about any of them. I mean, young Sean Houston was something like 19 or 20 years of age in the mendicity, and the guys in his group that were defending the building, some of them were only 12 and 13. So, you know, they were all, to me, worthy of recognition, if you like. So, as you say, you've got to decide, you've only 48 pages, who are you going to concentrate on? So I concentrated on the leaders, and we stuck to that.
And what type of feedback have you got, particularly maybe from people who wouldn't sit down and read a history book, but might read a graphic novel, or maybe younger people?
The feedback has been pretty good. I mean, for argument's sake, the one about 1916, Blood Upon the Rose, is now in its third print, which for a graphic novel in Ireland, I think is a good achievement. The War of Independence with Michael Collins, that was shortlisted last year for a Book of the Year, and I think it was a first for a comic or a graphic novel, whatever you like to call it. It's always books that are shortlisted, but here we suddenly had a graphic novel. So people are picking it up and they're being attracted to it. Mm. And it's nice to think that we're all doing a little bit. I mean, I'm not the only one, obviously, at the moment. There are more and more young artists, and they're doing excellent work.
And do you think arts are looking at Irish history as an inspiration for graphic novels, more so than fantasy or superhero, more so stuff that they would be doing in the past?
Well, they are, because my publisher is O'Brien Press. And they seem to be the only publishers now who are following that route, the graphic novel. And they've had some great guys do stuff for them. I mean, we're having a lot of historical stuff. We've had Brian Boru, we've had Cú Chulainn, we've had my stuff. So they are really getting into the historic end of it. And it's a good thing, I suppose, in a way. It's something, I suppose, we all like to look back on and that we're a bit proud of and that sort of thing.
And do you think the Irish graphic novel buying public are excited by the fact that they have Irish titles now to choose from, or Irish subject matter to choose from?
Well, they must be attracted, because when you get a publisher like O'Brien Press who's prepared to take it on, I mean, let's face it, these people have staffs to pay, they've a workforce, they've got to be making money, and when they see that they produce like 1916, then they come back for the War of Independence, then they come back for Blood Upon the Rose, or for 1913, and not just my stuff, they're bringing in new guys all the time. They've got guys like Paddy Lynch, they've got loads of other guys that I can't remember, they've got Alan Nolan. They're building their staff all the time of artists who do nothing but graphic novels. So they must be getting a very good reaction to it. People are obviously buying them.
What do you think about the commemorations for 1913 coming up this year? How do you think novels, plays, graphic novels, films fit into the idea of commemorating an event like 1913?
Anything to do with like plays or comics or commemoration gatherings or that sort of thing, to me that's all very welcome. Because I think these people, they were terrific. They lived in ferocious circumstances. They fought the long fight. They didn't really win it. But in the long run, they won it because they succeeded in getting unions established. And anything that can be done to commemorate them for me is a huge bonus. It's something I would welcome with open arms.
And did you feel in your research that you got a much deeper understanding of an event like 1913 and maybe drawn the parallels to today, how we got to where we are today? Can we understand Dublin in 2013 if we don't look back to Dublin in 1913?
I found that when I was doing the research, I was shocked at what I read and what I got, because I had, like us all, I had a vague notion of 1913 and what happened and that sort of thing and the strike. But we mainly tended to concentrate on the strike and on the fellas, you know, being laid off and the meetings and that sort of thing. We didn't tend to concentrate as much on what brought about the strike. And for me, that came to the fore in my research, because the awful conditions that people were living in. I mean, I know it was then, and money, the value of money is sort of completely different now. But even then, imagine trying to raise a family on 15 shillings a week. And then when you went on strike, that's down to 5 shillings a week. And eventually, you're at a stage where you've got to rely on food ships coming from England. I mean, that's an awful situation to be in. And then when they were brought back after the strike, they were brought back experienced fellas who might have been 10 or 15 years working for a company. They were brought back as new hands on lower wages than what they had before. And they were so glad to get some money in their pocket again, a few shillings again, that they just went back. Now, I still, having done the book, I still often have to sit back and think and wonder about these people, the conditions they lived in and what they had to put up with from people like William Martin Murphy, the various employers and that sort of thing. And of course, I suppose as well, something that I didn't know at the time, we have to thank the trade unions in England who supported them right through for 8 months. They sent money over and they sent shipments of food over. And of course, without that, the strike would never have lasted 8 months.
Well, one of the things that's being discussed at the moment, Gerry, is removing history as a compulsory subject from the junior cert. At present, it's not compulsory for the leaving cert, but the government want to remove it as a core subject from the junior cert. If that becomes the case, do you think things like graphic novels, films, can almost fill a gap for people who aren't being exposed to Irish history in school anymore?
I honestly don't think it would adequately fill a gap. I think myself that history being taught in schools is, for me, a must. It's essential. Because, let's face it, we have to know what went on before. And not just in our own country. We've got to know what went on in England and all over the place to appreciate, I suppose, if you'd like to think of it, how far we've come, or whether we've come in a positive way or in a negative way. We'd like to be able to compare. I mean, I wasn't all that keen on history when I was a kid, but now that I look back on it, I'm delighted that I learned the subject, and that I have some idea of things that happened worldwide, I suppose. And I suppose especially in this country. Let's face it, I mean, it would be awful if we didn't know about Brian Boru even, you know, Patrick Sarsfield, and then closer to home, even about Joe Plunkett and James Connolly and those people. Where would we be if we hadn't learned about those people?
And when you're talking to people who've read your novels, does anyone ever say to you, oh, I had no idea that this happened until I read it in your book?
They have said it to me. Oh, they have indeed said it to me, because I suppose those people would be a bit like myself. I had no idea it happened, an awful lot of what I have in the book, until I did the research. As I said to you, I had a father who was involved in 1916 and 1919, but he died when I was 10. He never spoke about it anyway. He would just say, well, it was something that had to be done and someone had to do it. And he left it at that. So I relied on my research. Even though I had done history at school, they don't go into it in such depth as you would when you're doing research. And the people reading the novels, they said it to me. Even people in the pub, you know, fellas who spend all their time talking about football. And they hear about me and my comic, and they ask me, can they have a copy? And they come back the next day, and I used to think, well, maybe I'm just wasting my time here. These guys are going to chuck it in the bin. They're only doing it through politeness. No! You'd know from talking to them that they had read it from cover to cover, and that it had whetted their appetite for a bit of history.
Is that one of the benefits that you noticed, that somebody who wouldn't sit down and read a 250-page history book will look at a comic book, maybe 48 or 68 pages, and say, well, this doesn't look too daunting, and just start off on it?
Well, I suppose there's that to it, all right. There is that to it, all right. I mean, unless you're an out-and-out historian, very few people are going to buy a book that's just full of words, whereas a comic with illustrations, it looks, to me at any rate, and I've no doubt a lot of other people think it, and I'm just not talking about mine, but about any graphic novel, with the illustrations, it looks that little bit more attractive. And as you say, you can look through it, or you can flick through it, and you can pick through. Whereas with a book, it's a serious thing. You've got to start reading and word after word. I find it very tiring reading books.
And is there any other aspects or periods in Irish history that appeal to you for future novels?
I'd love to do one on Patrick Sarsfield. Now, that's going well back. The Civil War I have shied away from, because there are people still alive who had relations in the Civil War. My father didn't get involved in the Civil War. He went to America, like a lot of them did, because it was an awful time. I'd like to do something on it, but for the moment, I just don't have the guts. I don't have the courage, maybe, to have people stop me and say, look, that was all wrong. It didn't happen like that. Civil War was very close to where we are now. But there are other ones, I mean, right up to today. I mean, the provisional campaign in the north of Ireland. I think that would make a good comic. You know, you've got loads of stuff happening. We have, and I'm talking purely about historical stuff, we've got the different things that have happened through the last few years with our banks and stuff like that. I mean, they would make great comics. But there again, you'd want to get your facts right, in case you wouldn't want to be sued or anything like that.
Much darker in some ways than some of the other material.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
But as we're talking there about 1913, almost a replication of the same stories of greed and avarice.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, except that it was... now, yes, I suppose you could say that. In 1913, it was the employers who just kept the workers like slaves, really. Nowadays, it was the bankers and the developers, and we're all paying for it now. So I suppose you could equate the two to a certain extent.
And would you be attracted by the idea of doing a 200-page graphic novel, like a really long comic?
I would. In fact, I have a great friend who's now living in Spain, a fellow called Bob Bourne, and he beat me to something that I wanted to do, but he got there first, and good luck to him. We've talked about pictures here, and we've talked about people being attracted by pictures. I've always felt that with a good graphic novel done by a good artist, there should be no need for words at all. It should be like the old silent movie. And I was always thinking of doing that, but I never got around to it, but he did. And he produced one, and it's about 200 pages. And it's terrific, and it's fictitious, but it's about Mr. Amperduke, and he does all these quirky little characters, and they're terrific, and there isn't a word in it, and yet you've no trouble following it, and that's what I'd love to do.
So that must be interesting, though, as a medium, that you're not dependent on language. You give that comic book to somebody from Spain or South America or China, and they can
absolutely
get the same thing out of it.
That's what I feel about it. If you've just pictures, anyone can understand a good picture. And as long as one panel leads to the next, and you don't have to be flicking around wondering where you are, as long as you can follow the story just watching from one panel to the next, it's to me, it's a great way of, I suppose, telling a tale, whether it's fiction or whether it's factual or whatever.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. Thank you very much, Gerry, for coming on today. That was Gerry Hunt, and his new graphic novel, 1913, Larkin's Labour War, from O'Brien Press, is available in all good bookshops now. You've been listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, go to the Near FM podcast page or like us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/The Irish History Show.